Well, I guess to kind of start off, this whole kind of journey for you started with a New York Times article about just someone getting into typewriters. Is that right?
No, I read a New York Times article about somebody who found an Underwood 5 typewriter on the street, like at 5 in the morning, coming back drunk from a party or something. And he said it was his favorite object. It was in his house. And for some reason, that stuck in my brain, and I was on eBay, and I saw one for like $6, and I bought it. And then it got sent to me, and then it kind of... it sat in my office as a work of art, kind of in the corners. And then I decided one day to fix it up. And, I looked for typewriter shops on the internet, and I found this one in Berkeley that was still hanging on. And I took it over there, met the family, and I just decided to make a short film on them, to help them out. Something I could put on YouTube that would, send some people their way. And then I made that, and Tom Hanks saw it through a friend, and then he said, "Hey, I'll be in it. I'll be, you can interview me." So it just took off from there. I kind of started. It was just something I made as a labor of love, and I just started making it. And through the making of it, I kind of discovered what it wanted to be.
Yeah. That makes sense. And looking at your background, was John someone that you found out was into it, or had you known John because of your, all the, great work you've done with music documentaries and music videos?
Oh, John Mayer? John, my wife read an article. She was in the supermarket. She read an article in Rolling Stone that he was living in Montana, and he was using his typewriter writing songs. And she told me about it, and I thought, I got to contact him. So through my production company, who had made a couple of his videos, they hooked me up with him, and I went up to Montana and filmed him over a 4th of July weekend.
So speaking of filming, how long was this, the feature part of it, filming-wise? How long did it take you to get all the footage?
It was a 5-year process, so I started it really back in about 2011, and I finished it in 2016. And it was just, really what took the time was the editing, because I got a lot of the celebrity interviews the first couple of years, and then I spent the rest of the time following the three stories as the three characters' lives changed. I met Jeremy Mayer, the guy who takes apart typewriters. I met him when he was sleeping on the floor of a shipping container in Oakland. He barely had $20 to his name. And I started following him, and then his art took off, and then he was, eventually by the end selling his work for like 6 figures to Silicon Valley CEOs. And then I followed, like the other stories, like the guy who, Martin Howard, who collects typewriters. I followed him, as he was searching for that rare machine. And then the people who own the California Typewriter Shop. It was just, a process of following their lives over the ups and downs of them trying to keep their business alive. And, and through the process, you really get to know people. So by putting in the time, I was able to, achieve a sense of intimacy with all the characters. And that kind of shows in the movie, I think.
Yeah, it definitely shines through. I'm kind of curious, as far as number of interviews and sticking with people, obviously like with someone like Jeremy, where we do see his full journey and the family especially, how many interviews did you go through? How easy was it for them to open up to you? I mean, what was that process like for you?
Well, Jeremy, for instance, I probably did, maybe 6 interviews with him over the time. So there was a first interview I did where we just didn't know each other, and I got a little bit out of that. And then I'd interview him as he was working on a sculpture, and then I interviewed him again in his trailer. And I interviewed him, maybe I interviewed him once a year. And each time, his life was changing and things were happening. So that's why I would re-interview him again, because, like Mark Zuckerberg, is getting one of his sculptures. And so, I got that. And I did that with each of the characters. As things changed, I would go back and ask them new questions and, things maybe based on what I shot with them, things that were going on. Like maybe when the shop was closing, I'd go back and do more interviews. So each of the characters, I'm sure I interviewed them 5 or 6 times. each time, you know, throughout the course. But the celebrities, that was, those were just one-off things.
You know, it's fascinating to me how documentaries open and close. That's always so difficult, I think, for documentary filmmakers. How did you decide on opening with the road test stuff and making it almost like a mystery feel to it? When did you get that footage and that interview? And then when did you decide, this is how I'm going to kind of bookend the documentary?
Oh, yeah. Well, Jeremy Mayer, the sculptor, he was really helpful to me more than just being on the camera. He had, you know, for 20 years been into this whole typewriter world and the meaning of the typewriter and everything. So he turned me on to the Edward Shea Mason Williams Royal Road Test book. And he also turned me on to Martin Howard, who's in Canada. He told me about him. And Darren Werschler, who's a philosopher. And so, yeah, so I heard about this Royal Road Test, and then we got in touch with Mason Williams and Ed Richey, and I interviewed Mason. And then about a year later, I decided to recreate what he did. So we took, I went and found the same car I bought, like a 1963 Buick LeSabre. It took me a while to find a good condition one. And then I went and did the whole thing where we threw the typewriter out the window and filmed it, and it was really fun. I mean, I bookended that. It's kind of just a mysterious thing because it's really like the moment where the typewriter stopped being one thing and started being something else. You know, it was kind of the, you know, it's almost like those guys saw something, you know, that, you know, something was finishing. It was finishing as a tool, and it was, you know, it was only a few years before a personal computer was made.
Now, with getting to know these guys so well, and the family in particular, is there hopes to keep up to date with it, or do, you know, maybe something online to give us an update of what's happening to people, or have you kind of put this into its own world?
Yeah, I might do that. I mean, the key for me, you know, this whole film originally started because I like the people who ran the shop, and I wanted to help them. And in a way, that's still my goal at the end. You know, if they can survive, if through this film becoming popular, you know, because every time it's shown, people want to buy a typewriter. So many people after the screening say, "Oh, I want a typewriter." So, you know, hopefully the business will pick up for them and for other typewriter shops. So I hope that they survive through this. And yeah, I might on our website maybe do some kind of link of the characters, and where at least you can see, you know, go access their websites and what they're doing. Yeah.
One of my favorite scenes is when Jeremy and him are going to a different kind of flea market type things, and they're just looking for typewriters. Can you talk a bit about? Go ahead and talk about how that sequence came about. Did they call you and let you know they were going to go, you know, basically hunting for a typewriter? I mean, that was one of the most poignant sequences in the whole movie. I fell in love with that. I was like, everyone does something similar to that, but who's looking for a typewriter? It was really cool.
Yeah, I had heard from Herb, you know, the old man who owns the shop, that once a month, there's the Alameda Flea Market in the Bay Area, so that's like the biggest flea market. People come from all over. It's the first Sunday of the month. And I knew that Herb went there every Sunday looking for old typewriters that he could fix up, you know, and sell in the shop. And then Jeremy told me that he sometimes goes with Herb, so I said, okay, I want to come with you guys. So I followed them. You know, one day we went. I just, you know, as I said, I shot this movie pretty much alone. You know, I did all the camera work, the sound, editing, and everything. So I was able to shoot it kind of just as a one-person thing. So I hooked those guys up with mics and walked to the flea market with them. And all that stuff, and you get that. And I had known them for a while, so I was pretty invisible to them at that point. So you get the real thing that's going on between Herb and Jeremy. And they're both there looking for different reasons. You know, one wants to find typewriters that he's going to take apart and destroy, and the other is finding typewriters that he can save and fix up and sell in a shop.
As far as connections to some of the kind of bigger celebrities, I mean, you've obviously talked about Tom, being wanting to be involved, but how did Sam Shepard come about and David McCullough? How did you get those two guys and involved in the project?
Well, I made a list of all these famous writers and artists who were still using typewriters, and I found them through this guy Richard Polt, who's in the film. He does the Typewriter Revolution manifesto later on. He has a website where he lists people who are still using typewriters. So I knew that Sam Shepard was using a typewriter. I knew that Paul Auster and Larry McMurtry and a bunch of other people, Harlan Ellison and different people, Woody Allen, were still using typewriters. So I just made a wish list of people that wanted to contact, and then I tried to figure out how to get to them. And Sam Shepard, I got through an old girlfriend of mine who's a casting director. She knew Sam's agent, so she contacted him, and you know, after about 6 months, we got through, and I filmed him over in Santa Fe, New Mexico, when he was working on a play.
Wow. I've got to ask, since this started, you know, really from your interest in typewriters, how many typewriters do you own?
Well, when I started, I just had the one, the Underwood 5. And then through the course of making the film, you know, I'd need to do close-ups of certain typewriters or whatever. And going to the flea market with those guys, I started buying them myself. And by the end of the film, I had 85 typewriters. And it's funny because it's kind of an addiction. Like Tom Hanks has 270, and you know they're not very expensive, and they're kind of fun to collect. So I'm gonna pare it down to my 10 favorite. I might kind of give them away during the course of the movie, the promotion, you know, to try to, you know, do little things to, you know, help get people to see the film or whatever. But they're great. I use one to just write letters to people, which is fun.
Is that first one still your favorite for nostalgic reasons, or have you found one that just really, like, that's your new baby?
No, that's funny. That first one I found, I never really wrote on it. I think I wrote one, I typed something on it. I mean, they got it working, which was great. But then soon after interviewing Tom Hanks, then I went out and bought the same typewriter he had. I found it on eBay because I needed to match some real close-ups of his typewriter that I wasn't able to get during the interview. So I found that exact typewriter. And then, yeah, that kind of thing. And so, you know, I love the Smith Corona and the Hermes typewriter. They're great. And the Olympia is really great.
So cool.
I mean, one other little thing that's funny is that John Mayer, when I interviewed him, he was using a Brother typewriter, which is like a plastic typewriter. But then a few months after filming, he met Tom Hanks at a party, and they talked about how they were each in the film. And Tom said, "Oh, you can't use that Brother. Let me send you an Olympia. That's the best." And then he sent John an Olympia, and now John's into Olympia typewriters, which really is, it's like the Rolex of typewriters. They're the most well-built typewriters.
As far as Richard and the typewriter revolution, have you heard from any revolution members or people about the film and on a positive level, like they're embracing it as part of the movement to, you know, continue, you know, this you know, thing where people are really interested in typewriters?
Yeah, some people are really happy. I mean, most people are really happy about it, but there are some people in that whole thing who are upset and saying, "Oh, you're going to cause typewriters to get more expensive. You know, I can buy them for $20 now. Now they're going to be $200 or whatever." You know, so there's always people who think it's, you know, that they found like this little tiny offshoot niche thing, and they don't like to see it become popularized. You know, So, yeah, you know, but most people are really, you know, really happy that it's coming out, especially in Richard Polt's circle of, you know, typewriter collectors and typewriter enthusiasts.
As far as, you know, with your musical background, as far as all the great people you've worked with, how much fun was it to do the Boston Typewriter Orchestra and get them into the film and showcase a whole different element of what... I mean, I know Jeremy's stuff is incredible, but to change it into music instruments, that's crazy on its own level.
Yeah, they're great, and they just came out with their first record. You know, they did a vinyl pressing of their record, And they've written a bunch of original songs on it. And that was really fun. I mean, they had written a song called Entropy Begins in the Office. That's the name of the track. And so I just, when I heard it, I thought it'd be really cool to do like a little music video of that. So I shot it much like I've shot, you know, I've made a lot of music videos in my life. So I shot it, you know, to be quickly cut and to be kind of visually interesting. And that was a lot of fun. It was hard to edit it, you know, but it was great. It was really fun.
What was the biggest...
I have the whole... When it comes out on iTunes, we're going to release the whole thing as a total, you know, as the full video from beginning to end. Because in the film, I just use sections of it.
That's going to be really cool. I've got to ask, when was the moment that, you know, in filming, I'm guessing in probably the first year or so, that you realized this is a different beast compared to what I've done? When did you realize, like, this is... you've got to change kind of the way your mindset, or did you never feel that? Did you always feel comfortable while filming?
Yeah, no, I never changed my mind, because I had made some short films, you know, documentaries that weren't music pieces or commercials or anything. So, you know, I was always comfortable, you know, telling stories, whether they were, you know, 15-minute stories or 3-minute stories or whatever. So, obviously for this, since it turned out to be over an hour and a half long, you know, it's just learning to make something that, you know, lasts for that length, you know, which is a different... I mean, I had to learn it myself because, you know, I couldn't get anyone to help me on this film because I didn't have the money to pay anyone else. So I had to shoot it and direct it and do my own sound and the editing. I think I learned to become a good editor through making this. But I, you know, I didn't have the money to go out and hire like a really good editor, so I was forced to do it all myself. And I think I got better at each discipline that you're doing.
What was the Telluride experience with the film and the audience's reaction for the world premiere?
Well, that was great. I mean, what was so great is Tom Luddy and Julie Hunsinger, who run that festival. I think that's the best festival in the world because it's a place where film lovers all gather and, you know, it's a celebration of movies. There's no competition or anything, so everybody's very supportive. So it was great over those 4 days because it played once per day in different theaters. And the first night we played, it was like half full. And then the word of mouth started spreading. By third day, we're in the Palm Theater, which is like 700 seats, and you know, Ken Burns did the Q&A, and he's a big hero of mine. So it was really such a great weekend, and so we came out of that, you know, feeling good about the film, and then we played a lot of other festivals after that.
You know, I know you've had the opportunity to live abroad. Have you been able to show this abroad to many audiences, and have you felt a difference in reaction from people abroad? Does the typewriter, you know, did it come across differently when you showcase it somewhere else, or have you gotten, obviously...
You know, it's only played in one festival outside the... it played up in Canada, where it got a great reaction in Toronto. And it's going to come out in Canada later in October. But it had a fantastic reaction up there. And then it played in New Zealand at a festival. And I didn't go, so I don't know how that went. But we have a company now that's going to distribute it in Europe and worldwide. So they're going to hopefully... I'll see how it's... You know, I think in English-speaking countries it will do really well. I don't know how it will translate, but we'll see.
So cool. As far as how has this inspired you for what you're looking for, what's next? Are you thinking still documentaries or, you know, like, do you mind if I ask what's next?
Yeah, I'm working on a narrative film, but then I also have a documentary film that I'm kind of working on both of them at the same time. So I'm going to kind of see, you know, I'm just, for the next month, we're just getting the film out there. So I'm kind of consumed with, you know, the work that entails, but then I'll get back to those two, and I'll start fully on one of them really soon.
Very cool. And lastly, I would love to know, do you have any updates? I know you said you'd be able to do stuff on the website, but any updates, since I know filming technically ended in 2016, like, anything that you can share with any of the people that recently has come about in a few months for any of the people you're able to interview?
Well, as far as, you know, the stories, it's, I think the main thing is the shop. You know, they've been going through real financial hardships because, you know, they go up and down. Like, you know, Christmas time, people will come in and buy typewriters. But then, you know, summertime, Berkeley, all the students are gone. So nobody's buying typewriters then. So they've been just hanging on, you know, and that's my hope is that through the film, now that it's getting out there, people are going to, you know, discover this shop and maybe, you know, at least they'll be able to survive doing what they love doing. So they're the ones who are kind of hanging on most. I mean, Jeremy's life is really good. He's working a lot doing his sculptures. And Martin has never found the Scholes and Glidden typewriter he's looking for, but he's still looking. But yeah, it's a shop. I really hope they can survive.
Well, Doug, I really loved the documentary, and thank you for the time. And like you said, I hope it does help out the family and getting the shop to be a little bit more well-known and utilized. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks so much. It was nice talking to you.